Creative Resistance Part 2, or Counter-Espionage and Active Privacy Protection. This is just like a summary of some of the themes, but what we want you to do in this session is that we want to listen to the creative practitioner. In our world of ever more specialization, there is often a huge gap between those who can actually do things and those who do the talking. For us, it was important to make the point that the doers can also talk, even more so as those who usually talk often have just a very foggy grasp of the technology. So that the technology underpinning is not very understood, which can lead to things such as techno-mysticism and media art guruism, some of the issues I think Conrad has addressed earlier. So we wanted to hear it directly from the people who actually do things and who are involved with those technologies. Our first presenter, we would like to welcome Graham Harwood of Mongrel and MediaShed. With the group Mongrel, Harwood started a discourse about social software quite a few years ago, actually, I think. When was that, like 98 or something? Yeah. And Mongrel's definition of social software was also a very different one, wasn't it? It was like, yeah. Can you say a word about it?
I mean, the thing is, with the kind of software we was doing, we was working with communities that didn't have very much. And so what we was doing was designing systems that allowed them to work. And so our idea of social software was one in which the programmer and the user were closely linked together. And that the programmer and the conceptual work was coming from usually reasonably poor or marginalized communities.
So that's a very different concept of social software.
Yes, it went somewhere else.
How comes the terms got sort of hijacked? Because you used the term in 98, I'm aware of that. I interviewed you then.
Yeah, we used it early on. I think Matthew Fuller was the one that first started using it around our work. And then, yes, it moved on from there.
So then that culminated in projects such as Linker and 9x9. And then you took your own work into a slightly different direction, creating speculative software, called it projects such as NetMonster, where there were some collaborations with Francesca also. And in recent years, Harwood has moved to Southend-on-Sea. It's a very interesting place in it. This is where the retired gangsters take their spouses for a day out at the seaside.
Yeah, it's full of white trash. And it's described as the most tasteless part of the most tasteless county in the most tasteless country in Europe. So I think that gives you some idea of kind of what it's like.
So it is the most unlikely of places to found a media activist group and media activists.
Yeah, these are the people, like, it was Margaret Thatcher's storm troops against the miners in the 1980s. So it was the perfect place for me to arrive and work, especially as Mongrel was associated with race and racialization and you know, like a completely mixed collective, to go somewhere ultra white to work,
so,
yes.
So we are looking very forward to you talking a little bit about the work that you're doing in Southend.
Okay.
Graham, please.
Thank you.
Welcome, Graham Harwood.
Yeah. We have some life. And what's really good is I'm using Linux, and so Linux kind of cuts off slight edges of the screen. So it's not going to be perfect, which I think is a really good starter. So I kind of move things around until they roughly get there, which is really good. On the way in, did people get one of these? Hold one of these up if you got one. Who got one? Elizabeth? Who got one of these? Wow. That's poor shine. There should be a lot more around in the room. And the idea was that because I can't... I'm not going to spend much time talking about the media share because it's impossible in the short amount of time. What I was hoping is that people would actually share them so that I don't have to do that bit of work. I've got a really go some to get through what I need to say in a very short period, so bear with me, please. Essentially, Mongrel's approach to surveillance is free media. And free media is founded on a misunderstanding. I really enjoy kind of misreadings and misunderstandings. In South End, where I worked, which I just described as this most tasteless white trash place, when we went there and so we started talking about free media, what people thought was that it was, you know, for free. Not that it was open source, not that it was Linux, that it was for free. And to give you some idea of where that has, that's come to mean for us, I'll just read a little bit to you. So essentially, Mongrel's approach to surveillance is free media, which sets up a series of ways that allow it to become, that allow media to become strange to people, to allow it to become a space of fun and experimentation, of expanded thoughts and actions. It is about releasing the full potential of media, allowing signals, things, objects, people and actions to pass freely between each other. It's about opening up the implicit meaning of media itself to mediate not by controlling and ordering what can be said, shown or heard, but by providing the means to unblock channels of access, release currents of energy and reveal the margins of what people can feel, sense and imagine. The Media Shed is a Mongrel project, and what we did, we arrived in this space trying to do media art, and no one could even, didn't even know what art was. No interest in art. The main cultural form, or a really interesting cultural form, is things like noise cars, where people fill up cars with huge speakers and play them in the street. But people didn't even understand that as a kind of cultural form. And one of the early projects we did, we got this really vast space where we have our servers, and we asked people, we started to try and invite artists, and they didn't want to know us, they just wanted to carry on with whatever they were doing. So we invited people doing things like radio hams, who were doing things like broadcasting TV signals to Germany, but just with a transmission signal, just with a test card. We said we can think of more interesting things to do with that. They were also doing things like there were some radio hams attaching, getting school kids to be able to talk to orbiting space stations. So we thought, well, that's a much more interesting group. We'll work with those. So they come into the space. And so we set up this space as a way of people, unusual people, making alliances together. And one of the first projects that we did was a project called Video Sniffing. I'm going to show you two films about our notion of surveillance and how we play with it. Okay, what video sniffing entails is we was working with a group of homeless kids in Southend. Homeless kids in Southend would do things like, you know, sell themselves on the beach for money during the day and then in the evening run a bit of crack, you know. So they're kind of, they're your average kind of, you know, London kids, but by the seaside. And so what we was trying to do was think of projects that they'd be really interested in. And what we found was that we found a small device that you could buy in a local hardware shop, and that could sniff out the signals in local, you know, supermarkets, anywhere with a closed-circuit TV system, a wireless system. So here on the screen, what you've got is where they went out on the bicycles and then jotted down all these different places within Southend that they could get the signals and they could actually suss out what was going on in the store. Okay? And then the next step was that they, the whole point of the Media Shed with its notion about free media, is that to not pay for it. So there's a few slogans that people had, like, I don't pay, I won't pay, I can't pay. And the idea in the Media Shed is that everything is built out of recycled equipment, so we don't use new equipment. Everything is bought out of bins, and then we convert it into other processes. And so looking at this surveillance network that people were that was actually targeted at these young people, what they decided to do was make a film using the surveillance network as a movie that would advertise the Media Shed. And what I'll do is I'll show you a quick bit of that, hopefully. We'll be right back. Okay, that gives you a general idea of what people were doing, which is like taking a control system and then actually turn it against itself and turn it into a broadcast medium for themselves, and also making films for free, for no money. Okay, so that was a kind of like clear part of approach to surveillance. And we've been working with iBeam in New York to produce a project called Gearbox. And in Gearbox, that's a way of people uploading a number of tools with which people can carry on this free media toolkit, invent new tools, and so on. And also, at the same time, we were asked by Drew Hemnett, wherever he is, for Future Sonic. Oh, there he is. There's Drew down there. To work in the Arndale Centre in Manchester. And he asked us to do a number of projects, and one of the projects that we were doing there was a project called Netmonster. And I'm going to briefly touch on this because I think it's important for the data mining question that was earlier and an artistic approach to data mining. This is a picture of that's a composite picture of many, many search items that were gleaned about the Arndale Centre in Manchester, which was the site of a bombing in 1996 by the IRA, which obliterated Manchester town centre. And what you have in this image is you have two characters, they're hunger strikers, and the postbox in the middle is a postbox that survived the bombing, the only thing that survived. And if I can do it, I will zoom into to this image, and you will see what this is about data mining, is that what this is basically a huge number of searches that have then come back, and the text that radiates out of any image is text that was found on the page that image was actually harvested from. And in the installation in the Arndale, what you've got is this info booth, and this is two hunger strikers on a site that was devastated by an IRA bomb. So for those people in the UK who are here, they would know the symbolism of these hunger strikers who died in the early 1980s after smearing shit on their cells. And what you get in the info booth is something like this, which is there's two monitors there, there's a bunch of searches of keywords around the edge, and the monitor would show which key search it was looking for, show the images, show the text. Well, this is slightly off the point, but what I'm going to say is that what this revealed was that the space, which had about £600 million spent on it in the centre of Manchester, had turned from being a public area into a proprietary area. So when a company, when Marks and Spencers built its new store, instead of Marks and Spencers having, there was people protesting outside of it, they were got rid of by Marks and Spencers, not by going to the law courts, because Marks and Spencers owned the street. So the companies owned the street. So proprietary space was creeping method of surveillance. The Arndale is, I think, is it Drew, the biggest shopping centre in the UK? One of the biggest shopping centres in the UK. And what Drew, through his very slippery silver tongue, managed to do was get permission for us to have three nights in the Arndale Centre in which we could record two parkour free-running youth from Southend who could run wild in this proprietary space. And the idea was, because the Netmonster is quite a difficult conceptual piece, even though it seemed to work there, what we wanted to do was produce a piece that was very popular. And in the end, the piece that I'm going to show you had about, I think, something like 6,000 people a day. There's a huge number of people saw it. And I think Drew said to me that on the day that it was launched, there were two stories in the media in the Northeast. One was Tony Blair resigned, and the other one was two youth from Southend go nuts in the Arndale. So let's have a quick look at that piece. And I think what's interesting, yesterday when Manu was showing her work, that this is a saturated society with surveillance, and so our ability to play with it is all important. So I'll try and show the movie. I think it's this one. actually, I think I'm going to show you the opening sections of the other one. I opened the wrong one, and it's worth seeing the opening sections. Okay, if you can drop, someone can drop the sound off the video, I'll speak over it. I think it's worth it. One of the things you'll notice, which is different to most of the way that this was made by Dave Valentine from the Media Shed, and one of the interesting things about this piece is that he cut off all the signs that this is actually surveillance video. All the footage in this is shot through surveillance video, okay? But he cut it off, and this has gone on to go around lots of film festivals and things like that. Is it still running? Yeah. And what he did was he actually used it to make a movie. The quality of the video cameras in there, you can't see it on this bit, but on other bits, are so good that you can't detect its surveillance at all. The panning shots, everything is done within that that surveillance system. I'll see if I can move it on, because it can be a little long. Let's see if we can get some of that. Maybe not, but you get the general idea. So what I was trying to show was that, like, the way that in the Media Shed, the idea of approaching surveillance is to see it as a system of free media. I mean, you can see it there. The quality of the shots are quite stunning, considering that's all surveillance footage. There is no other kind of footage there. And what happened was that we was trying to show it, and we showed it in the space itself. In the Arndale, and there was about, like I was saying, about 6,000 people a day were watching it, and it was on all the main plasma screens around the whole shopping centre at the same time. And what happened was that the Arndale itself were very happy. They said, oh, you've given us so much free publicity, you know, this is fantastic on the first day. But then on the second day, they said, we're going to take it off all the plasma screens now, because the investment company that owns the Arndale has questions around why this has been put on. So someone sitting in a room in London decided they'd take it off. And Drew tried very hard for them to put it back on again. So it's really interesting that the idea of these people messing up their nice space where you're only meant to shop was just too difficult for them, too difficult for the investment company. Okay, I think I'll stop there because I know we're short of time. Is that good, Armin?
Very, very, very good.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Our next presenter is Dennis Royo, also known as Jaromil. He spent his childhood copying cracked video games at the back of his parents' computer shop, and this way managed to learn quite serious computer skills. Once he found that he was worthy as a programmer, he wanted to create a nomadic radio station. Via a few steps and developments, this led to the creation of Dynbolic, a Linux Live CD. Once you put this CD into a computer and restart it, this computer will run Linux, just a few words to Dynbolic, and then the computer is turning into a multimedia studio capable of producing audio and video and receiving and distributing live streams. As a hacker, a creative developer of software for cultural expression, and as a political squatter living in an occupied house in Amsterdam, Jaromil has a strong agenda, and I want you to ask directly for your speech and presentation, just to save time. No talkings anymore.
Um, So, before explaining you why I built, before explaining you the system and specifically what is so special about privacy in this system, since the latest version, I also want to explain you why, because it might be misinterpreted, actually. So at least this is my analysis. This is a quote from the New School University in New York. Much has been said about privacy so far, so I will just skip quite quickly through it. But I find this quote really interesting because it was stated 1 or 2 years before the 9/11, which is 9 or 2 years before we had this eschatological brainwash. And so I think it's quite interesting to note down. Web 2.0, that's a quick statement I wrote. It's about what you can read. It's the second part is the most relevant, is the fact that we have all the data of users collected into centralized servers is per se a danger, a threat to privacy. No matter how much these organizations can state that they will keep the data private. Actually, there are even collectives politically concerned serving their community, providing emails to communities, very good efforts, but still they collect everything in one place, and this one place can be raided. And these places have been raided, and the media servers have been raided. In Italy, Autistici Inventati has been raided, and a lot of other servers. And in the moment in which the police raid this unique place, then it's all gone. I mean, they have all the data they wanted to have. IP monopoly. This is another scenario. We have an intellectual property monopoly. It's about what is being called piracy. It has two aspects. There are two aspects. One is piracy of objects, and the other one is piracy of content. The first one I just wrote quickly as a statement. The second one is taken from Armin Melosh's piece, Piratology. So it's not my responsibility. that's something that, especially the first part, is something that concerns our mobile devices and who really controls them and is in control of them. The second one is about piracy of content. And regarding piracy of content, I would like to show you a little excerpt, a movie. Oops. So this is the movie is a pirate copy, and it's completely... Chinese production, presented at the Rotterdam Festival. If you can bring on the volume, please.
在饭店干活，后来觉得挺没意思的，就去那儿干活。就是钱挣的太少了。这是从哪儿来的？养活不了家，家里有老婆和儿子，还有父母。家庭困难，是不是两个年进的？对，8块钱一盘。能不能在家种地啊？种地挣不了啥钱，孩子上学要钱，父母生病也要钱。 都得靠我一个人。你们家哪儿的？
卖几年了？
2年多吧。
赚钱吗？
反正是比种地强多了。
那有毛病吗？
没有。
啊？
真没有。
我跟你说，
卖毛片是要判刑的，知道吗？
我告诉您，这是毛片，在这儿要判。
这是艺术片。
你带着孩子干嘛？
对。
你带着孩子打掩护，是不是？
風邪ひくよ。お前さんもう諦めた方がいいよ。
そうですね。あ、おい。
这是写人性的，这是艺术片。
这就毛片，你知道吧？
真是艺术片。
So that was it. I'd like to say something sad, but it needs to be mentioned. I guess.There was someone that died because of piracy, because of smuggling DVD discs. A Nigerian man was chased in Athens 2 weeks ago by undercover police and jumped off a window to escape. And he is not the first and he is not the last victim of such kind of chasings. And if you think over this, you think what a Nigerian immigrant in Europe, in the fortress Europe, could do for a living.He was just selling DVDs. It could be robbing, it could be selling drugs. He shared the same risk just for selling silicone dreams to people. And so I hope I give you just an idea of what is the situation outside of the same old schemes of intellectual property. And I'd like to warn you about this IPRED too. It's the Intellectual Property Rights Enforcement Directive.This is a quote, free translation from Giuseppe Corasaniti, he's a judge in Italy, that analyzed with 10 points this directive. He made a decalogue of points that are quite worrying about it, and it's being approved right now. So there is an urgency. That's what I'm trying to communicate to you right now. There is an urgency, and it's crucial. And it's about context, as we...heard yesterday. It was really interesting. So imagine this. Imagine jailed bloggers in Cairo. Imagine investigative journalists in Palermo, self-determined women, native communities in Oaxaca, or citizens demonstrating at G8. Imagine a state, like it was mentioned today, rightfully, that a state has actually the means for protecting people that is weak. But imagine a stateThat is not doing that, or imagine a state that is unfair. Imagine a state like that also in Europe. Actually, you can imagine very well by some episodes that happened to us. So, what happens is that building autonomous networks is a good effort, but it produces some risks, and these risks grow proportionally as these networks grow. Therefore,There are some problems and there are some solutions, I suggest. And these are just 4 points. There might be more solutions. But basically, I'm going around the concept of building architectures that are more solid, that are not centralized, and that are providing people with their own privacy by bringing them back the data in their own pocket.And the last point might be a bit more obscure, is that in extreme cases, scaling security from personally to collaborative, so basically distributing your private data among the trusted peers that you have, might be even a better solution than keeping all the data for yourself. So this is what I tried to do with the new version of this system, Diabolik 2. Actually,It's a system that I'm developing since 2001 with the help of many hackers worldwide, and it has some particularities. It's written completely from scratch. It's easy to employ, and it's targeted to multimedia activists. Since the latest version, it has a fairly strong encryption. There are details there for the techies. And it's quite easy and intuitive to employ as an encryption. There are, yeah.It's a reminder. So there are some screenshots, since I don't really use a graphical desktop. This is how it looks like, the desktop. The image is by the graffiti artist Faith 47. She's in South Africa. And this is a simple screenshot of the files contained into this Dyn directory, which is a simple directory you can put on your hard disk. You don't need to repartition the whole system like other Linux, GNU Linux distributions. In this one, you just put a directory, and inside the directory, you have two files that in this case are important for the discussion. One is the duck icon, and the other one is the key and padlock. So this is how you basically operate to create an encrypted file that holds your private data. This is, again, a recorded desktop session. It's a bit kludgy, but I hope you bear with it. You choose the partition, the size of the file. So you choose basically on which hard disk to create, and you press OK. You press on that padlock, and it starts creating. You will see the details. You can also be uninterested about the details of creation, but everything is anyway shown. You put a passphrase, that is your passphrase that you have to remember, and the system is created. It's created one file that is a key and one file that is holding all your private data. And at the end, you get a smiley, hopefully. Yeah, that's, and there we are. So how does it work? This encryption scheme I called Shezan, in memory of this cartoon, if anyone has ever, has ever saw it. Oh, I put a commercial A instead of, All right, I'll reboot. The fact that FBI takes the frame buffer, takes over the frame buffer when you, but I'll explain this. The system creates two files, and hopefully will boot in time. The system creates two files. One file is actually your data, and one file is the key. The key is protected by a password. So you have three levels. You have the data, the file, the key file, and the password. The key file cannot be used without the password. The key file is necessary to access the data. Actually, in this way, you can separate the data from, this is the password that is being asked at boot. You can separate the data from the key. And the password is also something that you keep in mind. So the specific problem which some people in Oaxaca, in particular, in the last time encountered is to bring some data from a point A, in which there is no network, to a point in which there is network, or there is the source of data, sorry, in a point B, in which there is no network. So in the transportation, you have a risk, a very high risk. You can be intercepted. You can be encrypting that data, but still, you might be tortured, or you might be, I mean, there are several things that happen in Oaxaca, if you want to update yourself about that. And basically, this, I'll get there. I cannot show Shezan the cartoon, but won't try again. So this is the scheme I just explained you, and you need the key and the password to access the data. So basically, you have point A that is online, and there is a dangerous transport. What you do is simple. You give the key to a person, and you give the data to another person. Eventually, you don't even tell them the password. Whenever these two people will meet back in a point B, they will have the possibility to access the data, or to have communicated the password from the point A. So basically, if one person is lost in this transport, then the data is not accessible. Consider also that you can break the key into many pieces, as many people is. So this is a kind of collaborative security scheme. That's it. You can try it, you can download it. There is a website Dynbolic.org. There is a mirror in USA. I'm particularly proud by the Free Software Foundation. Free Software Foundation is approving Dynbolic as one of the few GNU Linux completely free distributions. You have SDK to develop further inside it. Dyn.org is a website that is online since 2000. It's a funny place if you want to visit it. Rastasoft is my personal website. And these slides you can use, misuse, change, and do presentations. You'll find them on the Bricolabs website, which is a recent process project. And yeah, that's the copyright. And thank you.
I would like to introduce Marco Bellian, who is, I think, quite well known here, especially since this year he is also featured artist at Ars Electronica. So you can see his work at the Lentos Museum. You can also see his performance tonight at 11 o'clock, I think, at the Posthof. Is that right? There is a shuttle service leaving at the Bruckner House at 10:30. From 10:30 onwards, there will be a shuttle service with a free bus transferred to the Posthof. And I think hopefully everybody knows the Bruckner House. That's where the festival used to be. However, what I would like to say very briefly while Marco is still getting his installation up, he already has, what I find interesting about his work is not so much the technical detail or this or that feature, but there is a very big vision behind it. It's a vision which is combining a poetic and a humanistic vision, and which is sort of trying to pursue this vision by using the latest sort of tools in science and technology. And now I think we want to listen to Marco present his work.
Thanks. Good afternoon. I decided that today I will sort of talk, since they make me speak a lot here lately. And I have another lecture on Sunday, which will be more or less a broader overview of the work. But today I decided that I will present a very, very specific sort of quite narrow and technological niche that we have been involved in with my colleagues since 1999 on one counting and 2004 on the other, which is the development in the unmanned aircraft systems field. And you might know a little bit about these projects, or you've heard about them, or you know a little bit about the technology, but I will show you sort of the current status of the systems that have been developed within our group. It's been a very exciting 2 years, actually, and just in the last few weeks we have done a lot of tests, and I'll show you some of those videos. And as you probably know, there will be also a flight here in Linz tomorrow with an undisclosed time and undisclosed place, since we have some problems. There is no extraterritorial sea here where we could sort of escape. But the flight will happen. So this is a report, in a way, of our research group. The research group is comprised of a few individuals that are working together in the small town of Ajdovščina in western Slovenia. And this research group was started by myself and my colleagues, Nate Strost and Samo Stoper, when we decided sort of we'll take our visions one step further and make these things really work. So we conceived a research group in 2006 and used the principle of conversion, as it was defined in a book written by former U.S. Secretary of Defense William Perry, which talks about conversion in Soviet arms development. It's a very interesting book. Anybody interested in sort of Cold War history should read that tome. And so there was a, we found out there was a call by the Agency for Research and Development in Slovenia with a joint call with the Ministry of Defense of Slovenia. And that was a very, very interesting moment, of course. Together with our colleagues from DINE, actually, we have already crashed with the Italian Air Force during our work together in Venice at the Biennale and launched some stratospheric balloons with a rather anarchistic content. So these kind of collaborations are, it seems that they can function. So we gave it a try, and we competed with main institutes, and we won. Nobody knew it was us, because there is a university front that actually sort of is managing the grant and so on. But it's a university-industry partnership, your classical sort of 21st century Europe situation. The core of this is based around our unmanned activities since 1999. And the first prototype flights were made actually in November and early December 2006 in the Mirage Lake desert in California, also very quietly. We started to get some funding only in December 2006, but we've been developing this for a very long time, a longer time before. And we started the second flight testing sequence in February 2007, and the first prototype will be sort of finished in October 2007. And when I say zero sort of operational prototype, this is the machine that, you know, will be able to be used in very interesting situations. So this is, these are the partners, two universities, some more shady businesses, an aircraft company, Fotona, which makes lasers, and us, Sea Astral. What is the process? Now, this is basically when we really started working on this project, we realized that working in the unmanned aircraft systems field is quite a serious endeavor. First of all, because of safety. You don't want your machine to kill anybody or anything or destroy anything on the ground. So there's a very, very high degree of responsibility involved there. And all everything that is sort of can be funny and a joke is not funny anymore when you have something going 100 kilometers an hour flying over people and things. And so we really, really took this very seriously and actually implemented some of the methodologies that are used, redundancy in safety systems, and first and foremost, but also just, you know, the decision-making process is very, very slow, and it's not so chaotic as it usually is when we are sort of working with zero funding. So the status in the second quarter of 2007, we have tested two avionics systems. These are the sort of computers that guide these autonomous robots. And we are working on the third one, which is sort of our goal, which is a completely open source system based on Linux. And that is the one that is going to be tested in the third quarter. We have a ground control station with the telemetry, video links, and a powered management system, and a camera and a head-mounted display on our machine. So what we've been doing is basically testing all kinds of ways of how this machine can actually sort of function and film things on the ground by converting just normal digital cameras and putting them on board to testing video cameras. And we are also will be implementing more advanced optics, like infrared camera system, which is the one on the right, the OBGAL 25 micron system, basically for night vision. We are mostly using the free sort of frequencies, even though we, as radio experimenters and ham radio license, very similar to the licenses that are used by the people in South End, we can actually experiment throughout the radio spectrum, sort of legally. And it would be a very, very difficult court case to say it's illegal, this experimentation. So for now, it's going quite well. We have 25 hours of autonomous flights behind us, and I'll show you some of the latest videos from those flights. There are three prototypes that were built. The first one is actually displayed in our exhibition in the Lentos. You can see it is the spectral system, is the one that is sort of the largest and the most complex of them. We had also some spectacular crashes with that one in the past, since it's quite a heavy machine. But what we are using now is a more advanced aerodynamics system based on a so-called blended wing concept, which is sort of a flying wing machine. And everything, all the development is done in-house, really by, you could say, amateur aerodynamic scientists. And one of them is Nate. I don't know if he's here, but you will be able to sort of meet him also tomorrow. So the functionality of the system is now quite high. We can actually, we are able to take still images with very, very high resolution, and we are able to stream live video from a stabilized gimbal with a little bit lower resolution in the sort of radius of around 10 to 15 kilometers. For now, the systems are not encrypted for a purpose, because we are sort of working in an open way. But of course, it's not so difficult to also encrypt all of the telemetry, the communication going between the aircraft system, and also to encrypt, of course, the surveillance product. So what we are doing at the moment, we are integrating and testing avionics of a company called Proceros, and it's a closed system. We have the software development kit, but it's a closed system, but a very advanced one, coming from the United States. We are testing new communication solution. We have the side and forward-looking infrared camera and stabilized payload tests. We optimize the launch system. Prototyping the landing system. For now, the machine just sort of lands on its belly, but it will have a parachute in the future. We will also have mosaicing of data in the future. And also, we are working on the other very, very important aspect, and this is where sort of the whole work got entangled in a very, very bizarre subculture, which is that of the sort of unmanned systems engineering in the world in general. And we realized that we have sort of done a lot of the work that maybe some very, very large companies have not done yet, and that we have an enormous amount of knowledge in that field. And that is a very, very strange situation, actually, for us, because it's rather difficult then to sort of start hiding and going left and right with all of the work that has been done up to now. We are implementing also specific standards. The 4586 is a standard for interoperability of UAV systems, and also we will have a modular sensor package. This is the machine as it looks now. This is the sort of C-Astral W2007. Prototype in its first flights. This is the ramp we are using for the flights. This is how it looks like when it sort of takes off. And this is the area of our flights. You can see the red zone we have, that's also very specific for the country I come from, Slovenia. All we needed to do is send a letter to the civil aviation, and nobody believes this of this sort of in more developed places in terms of control of population that this is possible. And we just said, okay, we will do unmanned systems tests. We would like to do them. Can we close this area? And we actually sort of, with our principle, we used a former, it's a First World War forgotten airfield near the town of Vipava, and where we are testing, and it took 10 days, and I said, okay, no problem. And we know that they didn't really know, and they don't know, and I'm talking now, so maybe somebody is listening, that what exactly this entails. And we have a ceiling of 500 meters above ground, and there is an autumn published so that somebody doesn't crash into one of our machines. But it's quite a large playground, so it's a very good situation in a way, and one that is almost unheard of. This is how large the zone is, 3 kilometers by 2.2 kilometers. So a precedent has been set. Basically, when you have, you know, in the legal world, you have precedents, even though we don't have a common law in Slovenia, is a very good precedent. We can always sort of say, well, you gave the permission then and then, so on what basis you're not giving it now, right, when this thing will sort of be more complex, when we will clash with certain structures at one point. So this is the picture of the first flight of the Sea Astral spectral system, the large machine, the one that has crashed. These are some concepts that NATES has made for sort of for the future. And this is our event when the Dynabolic guys and the Italian Air Force people were sort of forced to collaborate together at the Macro Lab. And yeah, it was an interesting morning. This was like 5 in the morning. As you probably know, during our work with World Information Org, the para-institution that Konrad and his cohorts have been putting up for some years, we have also developed this signals intelligence and communications intelligence suite, which was also a first. It was in the middle of Brussels, the capital of Europe. An independent spy station was operating for 2 months, and nobody gave a shit. And we talked about it a lot, actually. So this tells you something. There's a lot of spy scandals lately, actually, both in Slovenia. We have some really interesting ones currently politically, and connected to Germany. The Germans are spying in Slovenia, can you believe it, in a cellar in the middle of Ljubljana. The German Secret Service has a communications interception system set up for intercepting all of the optical communications going from the Balkans up to the north. And it was published in the Slovenian media, and nobody gives a shit. It's quite shocking, because it's about really education. People don't understand. What does this mean? That you have some German spies? I mean, it could be any spies, really, right? In the middle of the city where you live, in a basement of a building where your friends live, intercepting all optical traffic going through the country, and you know, collaboration. So, out of that intercepts, of course, there are leaks, and we have a political scandal with some of these leaks, and nobody knows where the papers are and so on. But it was just in the paper 2 days ago that, you know, on the front page. Oh, and by the way, the German it is said that the Slovenian Secret Service collaborated with the German intelligence service from that basement in the center of Ljubljana. And this is like in the main newspaper, and then you look if there are any comments, and no comments. So we need some lawyers in our country that would sort of take these things to another level, to put it mildly. So what are our plans for next 2 years? We will have a small series production of our machine to have 2,000 flight hours, maximum takeoff weight of 8 kilograms, 3,000 meters altitude, all this technical data. It's not so interesting probably for this crowd, but what is really important is that the system has now the operability to be sort of used for all kinds of civil protection duties for what it was envisioned in the first place. Of course, the army is also very interested, but we don't know where that will go, because it's a really complex issue also for ourselves. But from our point of view, the important thing is that we have the technology, we own the technology, we operate the technology and the system, and we know how to use it productively. Are there any pilots in the audience? No pilots. Okay. So this is for pilots. But I hoped for a hand or two, I must admit. But so ADS-B is a very interesting system that is being sort of introduced slowly. It means automatic dependent surveillance broadcast. You will see ADS-B tonight if you come to the performance. We have some black boxes that actually take the ADS-B data from all aircraft overflying Linz and display their position, altitude, heading, and so on. It's a so-called virtual radar. So we want to implement that in our system. And for the ITASC project, which is a whole other situation, which is not only part of my work, but of a much larger endeavor, we will also be testing these systems for sort of more sensor data gathering purposes in the Arctic and in the Antarctic. I will show you now. Oh, I have to finish. I'll show you just a few videos, so you'll get an idea how does this look like. I have Windows on this machine, unfortunately, but I apologize. So this is one of the videos from one of our flights on the 24th of August, and you will see some of the features now slowly. This was just after takeoff. Just want to go a little bit further on. The camera is controlled through the telemetry completely remotely. This one that we are using at the moment doesn't have a zoom, but it's stabilized. So you can basically look around what is around you. And on one of the next videos, you will also see sort of the more advanced capability, which is following of the object. This is something that probably nobody in Slovenia knows it exists. It's a shooting ground of the Slovenian army near Vipava, completely newly built. It's invisible besides from the air, and it's on no maps. And we have done a few flights over it. And so this is where we are actually in the center of this picture. But let me find. Okay, this is, you will see the landing now, I guess. Yeah. It's completely autonomous. The machine lands autonomously. It takes off autonomously. You throw it in the air, and it takes off, and it lands completely autonomously. You say, okay, land here, and it does some circles, and it lands. Okay, let me show you the convoy following thing. Okay, maybe this one is interesting. It's a village called Slap. It's a secret. It's It's a very low budget project as from how much this project really cost. So this is a lot of man hours that will go, you know, very unpaid. So in the future, not in the future, in 1 month we will have another type of optics on our machine, which will sort of be, you will be able to zoom optically 16 times from this kind of resolution. So you can imagine there's a fair amount of detail visible. And I will show you now the third video, which is the sort of the black car is the car that the control system of the airplane is in. And the airplane automatically follows the black car. So I have to put down the speed because it's a 30 frames per second rate on the video, so it goes a little bit too fast. And we can leave it on. You can get the idea.
To cut off, but we have
to. No, that's okay. I've said it all.
The plan was to ask the artists back to have final panel discussion, but okay. We have been instructed we have to stop at 6 o'clock sharp. We have to give back the translation devices. So discussions will have to be in private. The artists are here. I think we can go for a drink afterwards, hopefully. We have to do those final discussions and ask further questions in private. So thanks a lot to the artists for these presentations. Hopefully it gave some outlook about ways of creating your own counter-surveillance system. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for your attention. Thanks.